Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for holding and welcome to today's conference call. During the presentation, all lines will be on a listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity to ask questions, and instructions will be given at that time. And also for information that today's conference is being recorded, I thank you for attention, and I now turn time over to your host, Dr. Charles Stoller. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to iPRO's Immunization Update 2004 conference call. Today we will be focusing on flu and PPV or pneumococcal immunization, and we're already in August and coming up rapidly to the flu season. It's never too early to start preparing for the flu season, and certainly now would be a good time to start if you've not already begun. We started these conference calls focusing on immunization last year and are continuing them this year as well, because we found that they were very enthusiastically received. And we've been very pleased at the turnout we've had to these calls, at least about 100 lines for every call, including today's. The purpose of these calls is to educate, update, and provide you with the latest information about the flu and pneumococcal immunizations, and to answer specific questions that you may have. Hopefully you've received the PowerPoint slideshows that are going to be referred to in this presentation via an email attachment. However, if you don't have the slide set, you can easily acquire it through downloading from the iPRO.org website. So if you'd like to follow along and don't have the slideshows, you can, if you have internet access, you can go to www.ipro.org. When the main page comes up, you can click on Upcoming Events for Providers in the middle of the page. It's a link a few spaces down, and that will give you a list of events, and the top event will take you to a link where you can download all the slideshows. There will be two speakers today. Dr. Pilecki will be speaking first, and she will be providing a comprehensive overview of immunization, including its public health importance, clinical features, and latest recommendations for immunization. My topic will follow, and I will be discussing reimbursement and some regulatory issues. And finally, we will have questions and answers at the end. And the entire call is expected to take approximately 1.5 hours. It's now my pleasure to introduce the first speaker, Dr. Sheila Pilecki. Dr. Sheila Pilecki is a physician who practiced in primary care medicine for over 20 years, and she practiced in the inner city setting and dealt with very high-risk patients. Now, over the past 4 years, she has shifted gears and is applying a lot of that clinical knowledge to her current position as a medical specialist and provider liaison for the Bureau of Immunization at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. She is an expert in the field of vaccinology and speaks and writes regularly about immunizations and related topics. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Pilecki.
Thank you, Dr. Stimler, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to this conference. When we think about immunizations and vaccine-preventable disease, most of the time people think about shots, if you will, as kids' stuff. And we do have a very robust childhood immunization program. And as a result of that robust immunization program, we don't see terribly many children dying of vaccine-preventable diseases in the United States. Unfortunately, we still do see some deaths, but the vast majority of deaths due to vaccine-preventable disease are amongst adults, and there are over 46,000 deaths each year from these vaccine-preventable diseases. If we look at a breakdown of these particular diseases, the vast majority, well over 36,000 of these deaths, are related to influenza, and over 10,000 of these deaths are related to pneumococcal disease. The other deaths that we see are related to hepatitis B, varicella, and tetanus, which we will not be speaking about today. If we look just at influenza, there are well over 114,000 excess hospitalizations each year as a result of influenza and its complications. The highest rates of hospitalization are, in fact, among very young children, and we won't be speaking about them today, and among persons over 65 years of age. 90% of all of these deaths, that is the over 36,000 deaths annually, are among persons 65 years and older. So it's our mature adults or seniors who are bearing the brunt of influenza. In New York City, where I spend my time, influenza is the third leading cause of death for individuals 75 years of age and older. If you're following in the slides, you can see that I've included a cartoon of the influenza virus. And this is just so you can get some sense of the complexity of this organism. If we look at how the viruses get named, which is important as we deal with the vaccine itself and understanding the vaccine, it's fairly complicated. And in this colorful slide, I've tried to explain where the vaccine gets its name, if you will. There are three types of influenza virus, A, B, and C. Only types A and B are important in human illness. After naming the type, it has a geographic origin. On this example here, it's Beijing. It could be New Caledonia. It could be Hong Kong. And that is where the virus was first identified. Because of the circulating patterns of influenza virus, this is often a city in the Far East. The strain, once identified, gets numbered for identification purposes, and so we have a strain number. Then we have the year that it was isolated, and all of this allows us to really label the virus itself. At the end, there is a virus subtype listed for the A virus, which includes a hemagglutinin subtype, represented by the H and a number, and the neuraminidase subtype, represented by the N and the number. And since we see these in the literature, I think it's important to understand where it comes from and what it means. All influenza vaccines that are on the market are trivalent, that is, they have three components, and all of them contain the same virus strains. There are two A strains, an H3N2 and an H1N1, and one B strain. Usually one or two of these vaccine strains are changed each year so that they include the three most likely wild-type viruses that we anticipate will be circulating in a given year. The selection of these three strains are based on surveillance from the previous year, what we know about viral circulating patterns, and expert opinion of this information, and trying to predict what we will see. Because the influenza virus vaccine takes many months to be produced, the decision about the strains that will be included in the virus, in the vaccine that will be available in the fall, that selection is made late in the winter earlier. So by February, the strains are identified for the next flu season. So it takes a lot of surveillance and predictive patterns for this. Each year, we see the potential, or we need to understand the potential for antigenic drift and shift. I'll start with shift first, since it's on the left-hand side here. The influenza virus can undergo changes in the viral structure. Shift are major changes that result in new subtypes. This is an exchange of gene segments, which occurs only in the A subtypes. And the result of these major shifts can be pandemics. And a pandemic is a huge influenza outbreak, as we saw in, let's say, 1918-1919, which really decimated the world. These occur very infrequently. There were three pandemics in the last century. Drifts, which occur much more frequently, are minor changes within the subtypes of the virus, and these are due to point mutations in the virus genome. These occur in both the A and B subtypes and may result in minor outbreaks, which we call epidemics. And as I said, these occur frequently. If we turn to look at what the clinical picture for influenza is, this is a respiratorily transmitted virus. It has a relatively short incubation period of 1 to 5 days, with an average of 2 days. There's typically an abrupt onset of fever, myalgia, sore throat, a non-productive cough, and headache. Except in young children who have vomiting and diarrhea with everything, even with a bad day at school, gastrointestinal symptoms are not a part of influenza. So we need to pay attention. There is no such thing as the stomach flu. You know, we don't see that, even though people use that terminology. Similarly, influenza does not typically include copious runny nose, you know, drippy nose, watery eyes, other viral symptoms that may occur with many other viral infections. The severity of influenza is going to depend upon the individual's own health status, as well as prior experience with antigenically related variants to circulating strain. The case fatality rate is somewhere between 0.5 to 1 fatality per 1,000 cases of influenza. It is not necessarily a benign disease. And again, all that we call the flu is not influenza. I mentioned respiratory transmission. It's important to remember that flu is spread by coughing, by sneezing, and by direct physical contact with respiratory and mucus particles, and may be transmitted by shaking hands, by contacts with objects such as doorknobs or the poles that we could find in buses or in subway systems, or if somebody's been sneezing and coughing on the telephone, even from contact with a telephone handset. As we pick up a telephone, touch it, and then rub our own mucous membranes with our hands. Individuals who have influenza are contagious before the onset of symptoms, usually for about 1 to 4 days, and are contagious for about 5 days after they have the first onset, or the onset of first symptoms. About 50% of infected individuals may not have any symptoms, but are still contagious. I've included a photo of what a sneeze or a cough can look like so that you can see what the spread of droplets can be like. We need to remember that influenza is spread by everyone. Children who have the highest morbidity and the highest complication rates play a central role in the dissemination in the community, in their families. Children sneeze and cough and may not cover their noses and mouths very well, and then if they do, they wipe their hands all over all sorts of objects. It's easy to spread from children to others. Adults are also major vectors in the spread of disease to other adults, to the elderly, and to children. It is adults who shoulder the largest economic burden for influenza, and as I said, the elderly have the highest mortality rates. The influenza vaccine that will be coming on the market very soon is different than last year. Strains included in vaccine change almost every year, as I said, based on surveillance data. You need this year's flu vaccine to protect against this year's flu. This year's flu vaccine will include the Fujian strain, which was identified last year and not included in last year's flu vaccine. It looks like we're going to have about 100 million doses of vaccine produced, and it's expected to be available on time. And vaccine supply information can be found on the CDC flu site. And our best information is that it will be shipped starting in mid-September. Influenza vaccine is efficacious. In healthy young adults, it's about up to 90% effective in preventing any clinical illness. As we get older, our immune systems age along with most of the rest of us, and it is less effective in preventing all clinical illness, but remains very effective in preventing severe illness and in preventing the ultimate complication of flu, which is death in the elderly in particular. It's important to remember that the flu shot is an inactivated subparticle vaccine. It does not contain anything live, and therefore you cannot get the flu from the flu shot. We hear this all the time. People say they got sick from the flu shot. In fact, they got infected a day or two before. Remember the short incubation period, got the flu shot, got sick, and blamed it on the shot. It takes about 10 days to 2 weeks for the flu shot to provide protection. That's how long it takes for the immune response to develop. There are some good studies that were done last year or published last year that demonstrated the efficacy of flu vaccine, particularly in individuals 65 and over. And in this population who received influenza vaccine, there was identified a significant reduction in hospitalization rates for heart disease and for stroke, and not surprisingly, for pneumonia or influenza itself. What was not anticipated and is very encouraging and very important data is that in individuals 65 and over who received a flu shot that year, the risk of death from all causes was reduced by almost 50%. People do complain about side effects from the influenza vaccine, and local reactions are not necessarily uncommon. Now, what people complain of is going to vary from individual to individual based on their own style, personality, and individual characteristics. Local reactions of a little bit of pain, tenderness, soreness, or even a little local redness and inflammation are not uncommon and may be seen in up to about 20% of individuals. Fever and malaise are uncommon and are seen most often in young children who are receiving influenza vaccine for the very first time. Allergic reactions are very rare, and neurologic reactions are even rarer. And all of this, of course, presupposes that one has screened appropriately. Again, you cannot get the flu from the flu shot. Influenza vaccine is contraindicated in someone who has a known anaphylactic reaction to a previous dose of vaccine, where it's clear that the anaphylactic reaction is due to the vaccine itself, or to a vaccine component, and those include egg, gelatin, thimerosal, or some other trace components. Again, if somebody says they're a vegetarian and don't eat eggs, that's not a contraindication to influenza vaccine. Being on a low cholesterol diet or disliking eggs in any form is also not a contraindication. It's an anaphylactic reaction to egg. An anaphylactic reaction to gelatin would mean that somebody cannot have any kind of capsule for medication or eat any food where gelatin is a component. And many prepared foods, including things like ice cream, may contain gelatin. Anaphylactic reactions to thimerosal are very unusual. Thimerosal may be used in certain contact lens solutions, and an irritation from contact lens solution with thimerosal is not a contraindication to influenza vaccine. One of the flu products does list in their package insert an anaphylactic reaction to chicken. This has not been substantiated anywhere else. If somebody says they have an anaphylactic reaction to chicken, we would recommend that you use the other product, and that it's the Evans or Chiron product, Fluvirin, that lists this. There is no chicken in the production, but if somebody says they have an anaphylactic reaction to chicken, it may be prudent to choose to use the Aventis Pasteur product, which is Fluzone. Moderate to severe illness is a precaution. Vaccine can be administered, but if somebody is moderately or severely ill, it may be more appropriate to defer vaccine until that individual is feeling better. Minor illness, including diarrheal illness, other upper respiratory tract infection, including otitis media, the presence of fever or the use of antimicrobial therapy or other drug therapy are not contraindications to influenza vaccine. Influenza typically starts appearing in very late November and December and peaks in January and into February. It is not too late to give somebody flu vaccine into the new calendar year, even as late as the spring. Vaccine product expires on June 30th of the flu season, so our vaccine that will be coming available will expire June 30th of 2005, and it may be used until that date. Last year was unusual, and influenza was identified earlier than is typical. And influenza is not a reportable disease, so we use what we call influenza-like illness and sentinel providers reporting. But as you know from the news media last year and probably your own experiences, influenza really was seen as early as October. It peaked in around Thanksgiving to Christmas, and by the first of the year, influenza really had just about disappeared as a major illness, although individual cases were identified. On this graph, it's identified in the red line that's shifted to the left. The green line in the middle was the 99-2000 year, which was much more typical. And the purple line, the flat line, which is towards the right, the 2002-2003 calendar year was an extraordinarily mild flu season and pretty late in its appearance. So who should get influenza vaccine? Anybody who has had a 50th birthday, whether you celebrated it or not. Anybody with a chronic illness who is at least 6 months old. Anybody who lives with or cares for individuals in those high-risk categories, and that includes each and every healthcare worker and household members of individuals who are 50 and older and who are 6 months and older with any chronic illness. All residents of long-term care facilities should receive influenza vaccine. We know that pregnant women who develop influenza have high complication rates and the recommendation has been changed this year that all pregnant women, irrespective of their gestational age, should receive influenza vaccine. So anybody who is pregnant should get a flu shot. All children who are receiving chronic aspirin therapy who are at least 6 months old should receive influenza vaccine. These children have chronic illness, so they would be subsumed by the second bullet. But chronic aspirin therapy in children in association with influenza may result in a condition called Reye syndrome. And all children, healthy children, 6 months to 2 years of age, should receive influenza vaccine because they have the highest rates of hospitalization and complications. If we briefly look at chronic illness, this includes anybody with any kind of hemodynamically significant heart disease, any respiratory disorder, chronic lung disease, and asthma, anybody with asthma. Anybody with any kind of metabolic disease, particularly diabetes, whether they're taking oral agents or using insulin, anybody with renal dysfunction, hemoglobinopathies, and anybody who is immunosuppressed, whether they're suppressed because of an illness such as HIV or AIDS, or they're taking immunosuppressive medications or other treatments. And so we get the question regularly, well, should people who have transplants, should patients who are on cancer chemotherapy get influenza vaccine? And the answer is absolutely, as long as they are at least 6 months old. Physicians, nurses, and other individuals who work in hospitals and outpatient settings readily transmit influenza to individuals at high risk, and they should get influenza vaccine annually. Similarly, anyone who works in a nursing home or a chronic care facility, anyone who works in an assisted living or other kind of residence, anybody who provides home care attendance to individuals in groups at high risk should also receive influenza vaccine. And all household contacts. I know I sound like a broken record. But when we look at the National Healthcare Interview Survey from last year, we see that only 38% of all healthcare workers reported receiving flu vaccine in the previous year. These are not new recommendations, but healthcare workers do a really abysmal job in getting themselves vaccinated. We know that vaccinated healthcare workers have reduced rates of respiratory illness, reduced work absenteeism, and in institutions where healthcare workers are immunized, there are significantly reduced morbidity and mortality in those facilities, particularly in long-term care facilities. I want to briefly mention a new vaccine that came on the market last year. It's called FluMist. This is a live attenuated intranasal vaccine. It's a spray. It's a pretty neat technology. It's called temperature sensitive and cold adapted. This means that it replicates efficiently in the nasal passage where it's cooler, but doesn't replicate in the lower airways. And so it provides immunity from this spray application. It has stringent storage and handling requirements. As we're talking about high-risk populations, it's important to note that the live attenuated intranasal vaccine, often abbreviated LAIV, is licensed only for use in healthy individuals between the ages of 5 and 49. So individuals who are on those, you know, indicated to be vaccinated really are not eligible for this vaccine. It may be used in close contacts of persons at high risk for flu, household members, except if the high-risk individual is severely immunosuppressed. But it does have a role, and you need to be aware of it. I've included a slide here about adverse reactions to this vaccine. The bottom line is it's a relatively safe vaccine and no serious adverse reactions have been reported. It also has contraindications. I'm not going to go into those today. Information is available in many places about this vaccine. Why do individuals not get vaccinated? Well, we don't deal with the misconceptions that our patients have. We don't deal with our own misconceptions. There's a clear lack of understanding by healthcare workers that influenza can be deadly for patients and their contacts. There are lots of misconceptions, including statements such as, I take my vitamins, I never get sick, and they go on and on. Healthcare workers are very poor role models for those of us on this call today. Did you personally have your flu vaccine last year? And if not, what was your excuse? Healthcare workers fail to explain the efficacy and safety of this vaccine. We know that patients are much more likely to accept immunization if it's recommended and offered by the healthcare provider. And unfortunately, the literature demonstrates that the physician needs to make the recommendation. Nurses reinforce that recommendation, but it's really important that the message come from the physician, whether an MD or a DO. There are people who are afraid of needles, and we need to acknowledge that. We need to deal with issues of reimbursement, and Dr. Stimler will be talking about that. And we need to address the missed opportunities for vaccination. We can expand our use of standing orders. We can have vaccination sessions for employees on vaccination days. We can bring the vaccine to the employee with a rolling cart. We can use incentives. And we have to educate more. I want to briefly move to a discussion of pneumococcal disease. This is invasive pneumococcal disease is responsible for a fair amount of adult community-acquired pneumonia and hospital-acquired pneumonias. It's a common bacterial complication of influenza. Invasive disease and case fatality rates are highest in our elderly. And as you all know, we have to contend with the issue of pneumococcal antibiotic resistance. And the vaccine contains many of the serotypes for which we see pneumococcal resistance in the community. The pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine is called PPV23. It contains 23 serotypes or 23 strains of vaccine. It's moderately effective against invasive pneumococcal disease. In fact, although everyone sort of uses the term the pneumonia shot, that's a misnomer. Pneumonia can be caused by many, many different organisms, both bacterial and viral. And as a result, this vaccine is less effective in preventing all pneumonia. We're trying to sort of get the message out that this is really not a pneumonia shot, because if we say to our seniors, get the PPV23 vaccine and you won't get pneumonia, we are not being completely honest. This is a different vaccine than we use in young children. Polysaccharide vaccines are not effective in children under 2 years of age. Pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine is recommended for all individuals once they've turned 65 and for select individuals between the ages of 2 and 64. And those are immunocompetent individuals with chronic disease and immunocompromised individuals. And our chronic disease recommendations are very similar to the chronic disease recommendations for influenza vaccine, but it does not include uncomplicated asthma. So an individual who uses an asthma inhaler as a preventive or for rescue purposes is not indicated to get pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine. But virtually everybody else is, and not included on this list is functional or anatomic asplenia, so somebody who has had their spleen removed because of trauma is indicated to get pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine as well. Revaccination with pneumococcal polysaccharide is a very confusing area, and it is recommended at least 5 years after the first dose for those who are 10 years of age and older, for those at the highest risk of complications, so those whose antibodies decline rapidly. If somebody is 65 or over and they received a first dose of pneumococcal vaccine at least 5 years earlier, they were are indicated to get a second dose of pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine, but only this second dose. It is not revaccination every 5 years. And if somebody got a first dose after the age of 65 and then developed a immunocompromising condition, let's say they develop a carcinoma at the age of 80 or 85 and they're being treated for it, they would be indicated to get another dose of vaccine so long as it is at least 5 years from the first dose. There are many missed opportunities for vaccination with pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine. Many individuals have been hospitalized in the past, and most individuals with invasive pneumococcal disease have one or more high-risk conditions that would have qualified them for a vaccine prior. Again, we want to observe only valid contraindications to vaccination, and this would be an anaphylactic reaction to a previous dose or to a known vaccine component. Moderate to severe illness is a temporary precaution, but it is not an absolute contraindication. What that means is we wait until the individual has recovered or is feeling better from their intercurrent illness, and then we vaccinate. I've included a list of invalid contraindications. Again, this is somewhat redundant, as I've said this before, but mild illness, antibiotic therapy, the use of medications such as insulin or antihypertensives are not contraindications to vaccination of with either influenza or pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine, nor most vaccines. We use standing orders and hospitalize and vaccinate individuals who have been hospitalized on discharge. So clearly, disease exposure or convalescence is not a contraindication. And you can read the others here as well. There are no contraindications to simultaneous administration of vaccine. That is, you can give both influenza vaccine and pneumococcal vaccine together, and they can be given along with other vaccines that an individual may require, such as tetanus vaccine or even hepatitis B vaccine. Vaccine information statements must be given prior to administration of each dose of vaccine by federal law. There are some bookkeeping requirements. These VISs are available in multiple languages from the CDC and the CDC's partner, the Immunization Action Coalition, and you can download these free in multiple languages. I'm showing an example of the current VIS for flu, or at least the top half of it. You should know what that looks like. It is important to record vaccine information in the patient's record, and in the medical office, in the hospital record. The use of flow sheets is to be encouraged so that you can find the information when you're looking for it. And these can be downloaded as well from various websites. It's important that families know that they've or individuals and their families know they've received vaccine, and it's a good idea to give everybody their own personal handheld immunization record. Again, these are available from many sources, and this is an example of one. We can do a lot better than our old remedy of gargling daily to prevent influenza. I encourage you to be very aggressive in your efforts to get your staff, your patients, and your families immunized to prevent influenza this year and every year. Thank you very much for your attention. Dr. Stimler.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pilevsky, for that excellent and comprehensive review of flu and pneumococcal immunizations. I just want to again remind people, if they need to get a copy of these slideshows as we go through them, they can go to ipro.org on the internet, ipro.org, go to the main page, the center of the page, click on upcoming events for providers, and follow the links to the slideshows. We're going to hold any questions for Dr. Pilevsky until the end of the call. And before I begin my presentation on reimbursement and regulation, I wanted to give you an important email address that you can use just in case you don't get a chance to ask the question that you want to, or if you think of a question after the conference call is over and wish you had asked. This is the email for Zeynep Sumer, who is one of our project managers, and the email address is Z as in zebra, S as in Sam, U as in Utah, M as in Mary, E as in Edward, R as in Robert, so that's Z-S-U-M-E-R, at NYQIO, as in New York Quality Improvement Organization, so that's NYQIO, dot S-D-P-S, S as in Sam, D as in David, P as in Peter, S as in Sam, dot org. So again, that email address is zsumer at nyqio dot sdps dot org. Now, my presentation will be on immunization regulations and reimbursement 2004 update. And I've tried to make the presentation interesting regardless of which setting you're from, and even if you don't do reimbursement. Reimbursement can be complex, so if you are not sure of some points, you may need to check with other sources as well. I will be talking about reimbursement across settings. I'll be touching on roster billing, nursing regulations, mention a few long-term care issues, and I'd like to suggest a strategy for following up on any billing issues that are discussed here. Since some reimbursement issues are complex or may fall out of the general principles discussed here because of special circumstances, wherever possible, confirm information with multiple sources. And the last bullet here describes some of those sources you can go to: your institution's legal counsel, your local Medicare intermediary for Part A, carrier for Part B, or your CMS regional office, or the QIO, such as IPRO, and you can always contact us with that email address. I'm going to start by discussing coverage for the flu and PPV shots. And one basic principle that is important to know is that the only existing benefit for the shots in Medicare is under Medicare Part B. So that for those patients who have only Part A coverage, they are actually not entitled to receive Medicare reimbursement for the flu shot. And that's regardless of the setting that the patient is in. So that even in the in-hospital setting, it still remains a Part B benefit. So it's Part B coverage for even in Part A settings. Medicare reimburses at 100% of the allowable cost. And in a few moments, I'll describe what that means. No deductible applies to the vaccine. No coinsurance applies either. And payment varies in different areas of the country, in part because the administration fee varies as it is linked to the HCPCS code schedule. Briefly, I just want to review what Medicare's specific recommendations are for flu and PPV, which parallel very closely the information you've already heard from Dr. Pilevsky. Medicare has defined high priority groups for influenza vaccination: persons aged greater than 50 years or between 6 and 23 months, people who are aged 2 to 49 years but with medical conditions that place them at high risk for flu complications, such as nursing home residents, people with chronic cardiopulmonary conditions, including asthma, metabolic disorders, including diabetes, renal disease, hemoglobin disorders such as sickle cell anemia, immunosuppression such as people with HIV, children on long-term aspirin, and pregnant females. Other bullets show that children who are under the age of 9 and receiving influenza vaccine for the first time are considered high priority, as well as healthcare workers and household contacts of persons at high risk. My guess is that everyone who's listening in on this call will probably fall into one of these groups. For stratification for risk for the PPV or pneumococcal vaccine, there are actually two levels of indications. There's a high-risk group who should have at least a single dose per Medicare lifetime, and those are people who are over the age of 65, who've either never had the vaccine before or who had only received the vaccine prior to age 65. Persons with unknown vaccination status, people whose medical records or histories cannot tell you whether or not they've had the vaccine, you should vaccinate those patients. And anyone who did receive the vaccine, but before 1983, when the new modern 23-valent vaccine was introduced. The group of people who are considered at highest risk are populations that may receive revaccination, who may get a second dose per lifetime if greater than or equal to 5 years has elapsed since their initial vaccination. This highest risk group includes patients with functional or anatomic asplenia, meaning they don't have a spleen, either because they lost it due to metabolic disorders like sickle cell disease, or it was surgically removed. Patients with chronic renal failure or other renal diseases such as nephrotic syndrome, severe immunodepression, which could be acquired through HIV, various types of metastatic malignancy, leukemia, lymphoma, or they may be on medications that make them immunosuppressed, like people who are on drugs for organ transplantation, as well as chemotherapy drugs, and any other condition that a physician classifies as being medically necessary. It's important to realize that vaccine reimbursement comes in two parts: the payment for the vaccine and the payment for the actual labor of administering the vaccine are billed with separate codes. The vaccine itself is paid according to 100% of the allowed payment, as was mentioned earlier, which is defined as the lower of either the charge you submit or 95% of the lowest AWP, or average wholesale price, which is basically the price that's found commonly in books like Medispan or the Blue or Red Book, where the lowest group of prices are averaged together. Now, if you're giving the vaccine, all providers must accept assignment for the vaccine itself. So there's no choice of not being a non-participating provider for the vaccine reimbursement. However, for administering the vaccination, you can be non-participating or participating, and reimbursement is comparable to the HCPCS code 90782, which is the code for therapeutic injections. Now, if you're a non-participating provider, you may bill the patient for administration, but Medicare does require that you submit a claim on the patient's behalf. I just wanted to quickly review over some billing codes so that you're aware of the latest updates. The HCPCS codes for the administration of the vaccines, and the G0008 is the HCPCS code for the influenza virus vaccine, and the G0009 is the HCPCS code for administering the pneumococcal vaccine. The CPT code codes for the actual biological itself, and the one that you'll be using almost always in the Medicare population is the 23-valent adult vaccine, which is coded 90732. And the flu vaccine, there are several codes, and there have been some changes this year, so there's a few bullets just pointing them out. There's a preservative-free preparation for children between 6 and 35 months of age for IM use, which is 90655, which you'll probably rarely be using. The live intranasal flu vaccine that Dr. Pilecki discussed is 90660. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but I doubt you'll ever be using that in the Medicare population. And the ones you will be using most frequently are the split virus flu vaccine of 90657 for children, 90658 for 3 years to adults, and the code 90659 has been retired. Sometimes questions come up as to whether or not you can bill for a visit as well as billing for the flu vaccine or administration on the same day. And the way the regulations and the questions and answers on the Medicare site read is that you can bill for all three if your visit is sufficiently complex in addition to the vaccine that it would qualify as a visit on its own, which means that if the patient comes to you as an outpatient provider or if you're a home health agency visiting a patient and the only reason for that visit is to give a flu vaccine or another PPV vaccine, then you can't bill for the visit. You can bill for the administration of the vaccine, you can bill for the biological, but in order to be able to bill for the visit itself, there has to be some other reason in addition to that that you're seeing the patient. It's important to remember to include an appropriate ICD-9 CM code to accompany the bill. Depending on the vaccine you give, it would be either VO3.82 for pneumococcal vaccine or VO4.81 for the influenza vaccine. And it's the VO4.8 code without the one at the end is no longer active for people who might be using that older code. It won't work. Now, who can administer immunizations? Interestingly, Medicare does not require that a flu or PPV immunization be either administered by a licensed physician or that that licensed physician actually needs to be present. So neither administration is required or that a physician being present is required. And the specifics of what's required actually vary from state to state because it's state law that determines this. And New York Education Article 131 states that either a licensed physician or a certified nurse practitioner is authorized to prescribe and order a non-patient-specific immunization. So those are the categories currently in New York that are permitted to order vaccines. Regulations in other states may vary. In New York, there's also a regulation that permits a registered professional nurse to execute such an order. So the nurse is not permitted to write an order, but the nurse can follow the order and give an immunization. I'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to regulations in a few minutes. Who to bill can be a little confusing because I mentioned that the benefit is strictly a Part B benefit, but the bill will go to the Part A intermediary in the following settings: hospitals, home health agencies, skilled nursing homes, and some other settings such as rural health clinics. But for those providers that usually bill their Part B carrier, they would continue to bill their Part B carrier for the vaccination, such as physicians, nurses, suppliers, hospices, or if you're a mass immunizer, such as a senior center shopping mall. And I'll talk a little bit more about mass immunizers in a few moments. There are a few billing caveats that you should just be aware of. One is that patients who are enrolled in risk Medicare HMOs, whose HMO locks them into a panel or specific provider, must get their flu shot from the HMO because Medicare has bundled in the cost of the vaccination into the payment that they are paying to that risk Medicare HMO. So that means basically if another provider gave the patient the shot, the patient that provider would not be reimbursed by Medicare. For persons who are covered under consolidated billing for SNFs or home health agencies, the SNF or home health agency must bill for the shot. Otherwise, there's no other way of getting reimbursement for the shot, so outside providers can't bill. So it's important just to be aware of other episodes of care that Medicare patient may be receiving. Another thing, if you're a mass immunizer, that you should know is that if you're giving the flu vaccine away for free, let's say you're a shopping center and you're immunizing everybody and you're just giving it away for free, blanket over all patients, you cannot bill Medicare for the immunization. Medicare will only permit you to bill if you're at least billing some of the patients with other insurances as well, so that if you're billing patients according to their ability to pay, so that some people may be getting free vaccinations, but others who have insurance are being billed, then Medicare will permit you to bill Medicare for the shots. Flu missed vaccine is a quandary right now. As I mentioned earlier, it's not clear whether any Medicare patient really should get the flu mist vaccine, since it's only indicated for younger people who are healthy, and generally Medicare patients aren't going to fall into that category. And as you know, last year, Medicare did not cover flu mist vaccine. The manufacturer of flu mist themselves don't know if Medicare will be covering it this year in New York. I've seen on the internet that there are a few carriers in a few other states that appear to be tentatively covering it with many caveats. They're not covering the administration fee, and they're requiring that people submit an explanation as to why the patient got flu mist vaccine. So my best advice at this point is it seems unlikely that New York's going to cover it, and I can't think of a clinical situation where a Medicare patient would get a flu mist vaccine anyhow. There is good news. Medicare will reimburse for the pneumococcal vaccine even if the patient had previously had a pneumococcal vaccine, as long as the physician could not determine the patient's vaccination status. So if you go ahead and you give a pneumococcal shot because you didn't know whether the patient had had the shot in the past, and it turns out the patient actually did, and Medicare knows that because they have the old billing record, they will still reimburse you for the shot because they understand that you gave it thinking that the patient might not have had it. And similarly, Medicare will reimburse for an additional flu shot in the same flu season if the physician can document that it is medically necessary. I'm going to talk a little bit about roster billing, and we're really just going over a lot of topics briefly with the hope here that at least you've heard everything once, and if there's something that you think is important to you or that you want to follow up further on, you can then go ahead and either contact us or someone else and continue to follow through. Well, what is a roster? You basically have two ways of billing for the flu and PPV shot. One would be the way you bill for any service for a patient, which would be to bill it on that patient's individual claim form, like you do, you know, a visit or EKG or spirometry or whatever. The other choice for the vaccinations would be not to do individual billing, but to consolidate all the bills into one long list, which is basically a roster, and there are certain requirements for that list. Now, any provider can choose to perform roster billing if they qualify as a mass immunizer and if they find that roster billing is more convenient for them. Even non-healthcare entities, such as shopping malls, may roster bill and may be reimbursed by Medicare if they qualify as a mass immunizer. Either the intermediary or the carrier may be billed, depending on the setting that you're in, as we discussed a few slides ago. The difference is that you use a different form depending on who you're billing. The carrier bill would involve CMS 1500 claim form. The intermediary bill uses a CMS 1450, also known as the UB92. And you also need to know that if you're billing for both the flu and the PPV, you have to keep the rosters separate. So you have to have a separate roster for each and duplicate your claim form so that it's attached to each separate roster. Well, a mass immunizer is very easy to define. They're just someone who is willing to accept Medicare assignment on the vaccination and who submits their claim on a roster bill. And there's a way to sign up actually online to be a mass immunizer, which may be especially useful for non-healthcare entities that are interested in doing this. And on the CMS site, there's actually a URL. If anyone is interested, please let me know. I can tell you where that is. You are entitled to submit your bill either electronically or by paper, and you can roster bill at any interval that's convenient for you. If you're a high-volume immunizer and you want to get paid quickly, you could roster bill every couple of days. Or if you do much less billing, you could roster bill as infrequently as every month or even less. Fields that are required on the roster bill are listed on this slide. I won't go through them because you could just refer to your documentation or this slide to get more information. One or two comments are in order. There's an asterisk next to the bullet referring to the beneficiary signature. That's because you do not actually have to have the beneficiary signature on the roster itself. You can use a rubber stamp that says signature on file, and as long as you have the patient sign a form that you keep in your records, then that's allowable. The date of service, by the way, is always the date the patient receives the vaccination, except in the case of in-hospital roster billing, where that date is the day that the patient is discharged from the hospital. So that's the only exception to that rule. I'm going to talk fairly quickly about regulations that concern standing orders in New York State, with a focus on nursing regulations. There is a lot of concern in the nursing community about standing orders, and I think the more we understand the regulations and what they do permit, perhaps the more comfortable we will all feel with writing standing orders and adhering to them. So the Title VIII New York Code of Rules and Regulations is where you find a lot of this information. The Title VIII enumerates authorized immunization agents that nurses are allowed to give, including flu and pneumococcal vaccines, requires current CPR certification of nurses who are giving vaccinations, and requires authorization by an order from a physician or certified NP according to a specified protocol, so that a nurse is not allowed to give a vaccination without an order from an authorized entity. The order authorizes either the specific nurse by name or authorizes a legally authorized entity such as VNS that may hire nurses. The order contains the specific immunization agents that are being given, the period of time the order is effective, which is both the initiation date as well as an expiration date for the order, the name and license number of the RN or the legally authorized entity, and the name, license number, and signature of the physician or nurse practitioner who issues the order. And the next page is a sample standing order, and it's fine except it doesn't actually mention the nurse and it doesn't actually mention the physician who ordered this, but other than that, it's a perfectly legal order. Quote, unquote, administer influenza vaccine 0.5 milliliter IM to all Bronx County residents who request it and who are eligible by protocol between November 1st, 2001 and January 3rd, 2002. And if you look at the bullets on the previous slides and compare it to this order, you'll find that most of that all of the required elements are in this standing order. This example was taken from the New York State Education Department Office of the Professions webpage. And I put their URL down here because from this same website, you can get a lot more information about the current regulations. Now, standing orders refer to a protocol. This protocol is required to be written by the nurse practitioner or the physician themselves. And for standing orders, it has to specify the population that should not be immunized, any contraindications to the immunization. It must require assessment by the RN of each patient for contraindications. It must guarantee availability of emergency anaphylactic agents. And it must require that each patient gets informed of potential side effects, both orally and in writing, which by law must include the vaccine information statements that Dr. Pilevsky discussed. And patients also need to be instructed so that they understand how to follow up if they experience an adverse reaction. The nurse who's giving the immunizations must understand the VAERS system of the CDC and how to use it. And they should specify on an immunization card after the immunization is done various information concerning that immunization, such as the recipient's name, the date, address, nurse's name, vaccination, manufacturer lot number, and recommendations for future immunizations. And with the consent of the recipient, efforts must be made to try to communicate the information on the immunization certificate to the patient's primary care provider. And what's commonly done in the case of the influenza vaccine is that a HIPAA-compliant fold-over postcard so that the information is hidden from view is commonly used. There is a record-keeping requirement as well, and it should just be noted that LPNs can administer the vaccine, but they are not authorized to assess the patient for whether or not they can receive the vaccine. New York state law is a little vague on consent issues, especially as they concern written consent, but it is clear that all patients in all settings who are capable of giving consent must give consent for the for these vaccinations before they are before they may receive them. However, written consent is specifically required for patients who are incapable of consent if the legally responsible party cannot be present during the immunization, and this is found in Title 8. In the case of minors, as long as the pediatrician is satisfied that they have the general permission to treat a minor sort of consent that's signed, and as long as the legally responsible party is accompanying the minor to the doctor's office, in general, pediatricians don't get don't need to get a an additional consent form. Specifically for hospitals, and I believe for nursing homes as well, the consent form that's signed by patients at the time of admission is considered to cover services provided in the hospital under the direction of a physician, which would include the vaccination in addition. I know that there are some hospitals that feel they want to use an additional written consent for immunizations, and of course there's nothing wrong with that if that's what your legal counsel is recommending. A few points about long-term care settings before we wrap up my presentation. Hopefully these are all fairly familiar to the people who are working in the nursing home setting. If you want to read more about this, look at the URL that's at the bottom of this slide, which refers you to the CDC website, where there is an excellent 100-page or so publication that covers all the details that I think you really need to know about vaccination in long-term care settings, but I just tried to pick out a couple of salient points. One is that clearly all current residents need to have up-to-date vaccination status. There's a requirement for vaccinations of new arrivals so that, quote-unquote, residents entering the facility, regardless of length of stay, should receive both the influenza, pneumococcal, and TD booster vaccinations unless they can recall prior vaccination or provide a record of immunization. Consent forms for immunization, if they're used, should be completed at the time of admission, even if the immunizations are to be administered at a later time. And please, very importantly, information about current immunization status should be transferred along with the patient during hospital admissions or other change of treatment locations. And we hear a lot of issues and a lot of problems from hospitals that are related to the fact that they're getting transfers from long-term care settings without proper documentation of, you know, vaccination history. And that puts them in a bind because we are recommending, as is the guideline recommendation, that patients who you cannot determine vaccination status on must receive in the season the influenza vaccine as well as the pneumococcal vaccine. So for those people who have already had these vaccinations, these are wasted doses and wasted efforts. And please, please remember to include documentation along with transferred patients. Finally, CDC recommends that your immunization program should undergo annual review, including collecting and saving your schedule of staff training, make tracking current vaccination status of all residents and new arrivals, status of Medicare reimbursement, and even track those people who aren't getting vaccinated and the reasons why, even if they've refused the vaccination. So in conclusion then, CMS has improved and increased reimbursement over the years for both flu and PPV. For people who aren't that familiar with roster billing, for whom this sounds like an interesting possibility, please look into it more. And hopefully the opportunity to review the regulations and consent issues will make us more confident in terms of implementing our system-wide processes. Just two quick notes before we take questions and answers. IPRO will be setting up a links page on our website to give you a series of URLs that you should find useful, I think, in terms of getting more information about immunization. And special thanks to Dr. Pileski for supplying some of those links. And we will be having an additional series of conference calls on the flu and pneumococcal vaccines in late September or early October. We haven't set the date yet, but they will be focusing on standing orders. Operator, are you on the line?
Yes, sir, I am.
Can we take questions and answers at this time?
Sure. Let me give out the instructions here on how to do that. Go ahead and press 1 followed by a 4 on your touchtone phone if you do have any questions or comments. And if you decide to retract your questions, please press 1-3, and all the questions will be taken in the order that they were received. And once again, it's 1-4 on your telephone if you do have any questions or comments. It looks like we have our first question comes from Ms. Angela Scott. Please go ahead.
Hi. I would like to know if there is a latex stopper on the vial for the flu vaccine for people who are sensitive to latex.
That's an excellent question. The answer is yes, there is a latex stopper. A sensitivity to latex, that is somebody who gets irritation from latex gloves, is not contraindicated to receive any vaccine. It is somebody who has anaphylactic reaction, and these are most commonly individuals with conditions such as spina bifida or other neurogenic bladder who are catheterized from often an early age. But it's not the nurse who gets a little irritation from wearing latex gloves. That individual can be and should be immunized with influenza vaccine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like our next question is from Ms. Maya Wheeler. Please go ahead.
Yes, I'm here with Maya. I'm Sherry Every. I'm the employee health nurse here at Kingston Hospital. On the part about record-keeping requirements of maintaining a record of all persons being immunized, including those offered but who refuse, my question is if we offer free influenza vaccine to our hospital staff, do I have to have something in writing from all of those employees who refuse to have it?
If I understand the question, you're asking if you need to have something specifically for each one that they're refusing the vaccination?
Yes. Like a declination form do I need to have?
No, I don't. That's not what this is referring to. This just simply means that you need to have, just in your records, the names of the patients who were offered and refused, not that they need to sign anything.
Okay, because it just said including those offered but who refused. That's why I didn't know if I needed something specific for our employees who refused to have the vaccine.
No, that's not what, I'm pretty sure that's not what this regulation
okay.
is saying.
I want to make sure.
I'm just going to add, although the regulation doesn't require it, there are a number of facilities in New York City who are using refuse to accept vaccination forms and putting them in employees' records or offering such forms to employees to demonstrate that institutions feel very strongly, it's not for the patient so much. We recommend that they get used as well in private offices, but it would be difficult in the hospital setting, although one could use it. And what this emphasizes is that we know that influenza vaccine can be life-saving and life-sparing, and that you, whether the healthcare worker or say the family or the recipient, you know, the patient, are refusing a vaccine, and by such refusal, you are putting yourself at risk. And interestingly, there are a number of facilities who, if someone has refused influenza vaccine and the staff worker develops influenza, and it is documented as influenza, does not allow them to take paid sick leave. I mean, there are some interesting issues that go on, but these are some sort of pearls for thought.
Okay, thank you. Maya, do you have any questions? Yeah,
thank
yeah.
you. And it looks like our next question comes from Ms. Joy Markwick. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just had a question. Can LPNs give and read PPDs? Is there some sort of guideline that states that they can or cannot do this?
PPDs as in tuberculosis Mantoux testing?
Right.
Not my area of expertise.
I think, you know, I don't have the answer for you, but that URL that I referred to, let me see which slide has it. There's a URL that points to the New York Education Department Office of the Professions webpage. It's the one that had that sample standing order written on it. I do believe that site has information on PPDs. So you might want to try going there and reading what regulations they have available.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. And it looks like our next question comes from Ms. Linda Green. Please go ahead.
Actually, the question is from Christine Hamby. I'm a pharmacist working with Linda Green. I had a question about the vaccine information statements. Both of you alluded to the fact that those are required to be given to the patient when you administer influenza or pneumococcal vaccinations. But my understanding of that is that the vaccine information statements are required when you're giving pediatric vaccines to an adult patient. So if you gave an MMR or a tetanus shot to an adult patient, you'd have to use those. But they're not required for adult vaccines given to adult patients. So my interpretation is that they're actually not required for influenza or pneumococcal vaccines, although it's certainly good practice to do so. Could you comment on that?
Dr. Pilevsky, do you...
I believe they are required, but maybe I haven't had enough cups of coffee this morning. Now I'm going to need to go back and review. It is certainly standard of practice, and I'll hopefully look that up as we continue with questions, and we'll post the answer on the website.
I also thought they were required as well. I mean, I've never actually read the text of the law that was passed, you know, to make that a mandatory thing, and I always just assumed they were mandatory for all patients receiving vaccinations. But, you know, we can look into it, you know, actually read through the law and get back to you on that.
Thank you. It looks like our next question comes from Ms. Marjorie Horner. Please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My question is for Dr. Pilevsky. Could you just speak a little bit more about the flu mist? I was under the impression that staff such as CNAs who work closely with the elderly should not receive that vaccine.
That is, in fact, what was said last year. There have been some changes for this year. And although with the flu mist vaccine, there is some shedding of virus from the vaccine strain that may be possible. The only people, and there has been at least one documented case of transmission of that vaccine strain of virus to an individual. It was in a child. Transmission does not mean the same thing as infection, and no one has gotten infected with disease. Okay, so there's a difference there. And the recommendation this year is that only people who are working with severely or profoundly immunocompromised individuals where there needs to be protective isolation. So somebody who has just had a stem cell transplant, or somebody who is undergoing bone marrow ablation or is in other kinds of reverse isolation, should not receive that vaccine. I think we are still a little hesitant and might say that anybody who is profoundly immunocompromised might be, you know, a close contact, whether a healthcare worker or a household member. But if you're just going to have somebody who's going into a senior residence, say, or caring for a senior who is not otherwise profoundly immunocompromised, the recommendations have been loosened this year.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And it looks like our next question comes from Mr. Jay Thompson. Please go ahead. Mr. Thompson, please go ahead. Okay, looks like I will just move on to our next question. Here comes from Ms. Susan Martino. Please go ahead.
Hi, I just want to clarify, in long-term care, we do not use standing orders. We get individual written orders from the physicians. Do we still need to get written consent from the residents or their families?
You need to get consent. Well, I'm not 100% sure of the long-term care regulations. Are you getting consent at the time that the patient is arriving at the nursing home for general treatment?
I'm not sure. I'd have to check.
I'm sure you must be getting that because you're not able. I mean, if you're
consent for everything.
Yeah, are you skilled nursing facility?
Yes.
Then I'm sure you're getting a consent at the time the patient's arriving for intervention and treatments. And I spoke with a vaccination expert up in the New York State Department of Health who's pretty sure that in the nursing home setting would probably cover vaccinations as well. But again, this is more of a question for legal counsel if you have a very specific issue about what type of, you know, given a nursing home setting, what type of consent you need, you probably should run it by them. But I'm sure you're getting a consent on admission from the patient. And if you are getting a consent for immunizations as well, a separate consent, then you could get both of those at the time the patient is coming into the facility.
Okay. Thank you.
One other thing, too, which is that even though your institution is not using standing orders, the standing order rules for New York State are across multiple settings. So nursing homes, long-term care centers, you are allowed to use standing orders. So that is something to consider for the future.
Okay.
Before we go on to the next question, in regard to the question about the VISs, I'm reading from the CDC website right now, and it says that vaccine information statements must always be used every time a vaccine is given, regardless of the age of the recipient. The influenza vaccine is not currently covered by the NCVIA, which is the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And so VISs for vaccines that are not covered by that Vaccine Injury Act don't need to be given out, and flu is included in that, although it is anticipated it will be added into that act probably this calendar year. So there is a sort of a back and forth about VISs do need to be given out, are encouraged to be given out, but the questioner was absolutely correct that under the strictest interpretation of the law currently, they are not required because they are not covered by the Injury Act, but they are strongly encouraged to be used and they are the best standard for information. When influenza vaccine is covered under the Act, which, as I said, is anticipated, it will be required to be given out regardless of the age of the individual. I hope that answers the question from that caller. And I think we can go on to the next question.
Okay. And it looks like our last question here comes from Mr. Jay Thompson. Please go ahead, sir.
Yes. Can somebody be overdosed from receiving multiple doses of pneumococcal vaccine for multiple admissions, and that patient doesn't have a record whether or not he had received the pneumococcal vaccine?
It's an excellent question and comes up fairly regularly. You can't overdose on any vaccine. It's not recommended, and pneumococcal vaccines, because they are polysaccharide vaccines, don't boost terribly well. So it may not add any significant additional protection. We don't have any evidence that more than two doses of vaccine provide any additional benefit, but there won't be any harm by it. The same thing can be said about flu vaccine. If somebody doesn't have a record of having had flu vaccine this flu season and gets a second dose of flu vaccine, there's not going to be any harm caused by it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It looks like that was all the question that we have.
Great. Thank you very much, then. I want to thank Dr. Pilevsky for her excellent presentation, as well as thanking all the participants for joining us today. I'd like to remind everyone that we would greatly enjoy hearing feedback about this conference call, and that you can download an evaluation form on the Internet at the same location that I mentioned earlier, ipro.org, going to the middle of the page, going to upcoming events for providers, and following the links, you will find an evaluation form. And we'd appreciate it very, very much if you would tell us what you thought and fax the form in to us. With that, we can end the call.
And that concludes today's teleconference. Thank you for your participation.